The Prophetic Gift in the Gospel Church. Chapter 10, Discerning True Prophets, Section 2. Rule 5. True Prophecies Are Fulfilled. There is a statement made by Moses relative to the true and the false prophets found in the 18th chapter of Deuteronomy, which, in our consideration of rules for discerning true and false prophets, may be designated as Rule 5. He says, "And if thou say in thine heart, How shall we know the word which the Lord hath not spoken? When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken, but the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously. Thou shalt not be afraid of him." Verses 21 and 22. The same thing is also found in the following scriptures. "Who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass, when the Lord commandeth it not?" Lamentations 3, verse 37. Of the prophet Samuel it was said, "All that he saith cometh surely to pass." 1 Samuel 9, verse 6. "When the word of the prophet shall come to pass, then shall the prophet be known that the Lord hath truly sent him." Jeremiah 28, verse 9. It is now over 58 years since the writer first saw Mrs. E.G. White in prophetic vision. During these years, many prophetic statements have been made by her relative to things that would take place. Some of these predictions relate to events already fulfilled, and some are in process of fulfillment, while others are still future. As to those relating to the past or present events, I know not of a single instance of failure. Before noting some of the predictions made during these 58 years, it may be well to note some that were made previously, which were in print in 1852. Before me lies a book published by Joseph Bates in January 1849 entitled A Seal of the Living God. In the book is an account of a vision given to Mrs. White in the home of Otis Nichols, Dorchester, Massachusetts, on the evening of November 18, 1848. At that time, there was a condition of war, rioting, and confusion which began on the 22nd of February of that year in the city of Paris, France, and had spread to over 30 of the principalities, states, and governments of Europe. Modern spiritualism began its rappings at Hydesville, New York, about the same time that the stir among the nations began. The First Day Adventists claimed that this stir among the nations was the rally to the battle of the great day of the Lord, and that the rapping spirits were the spirits of devils, going forth to gather the nations, as predicted in Revelation 16, verse 14, and that the Lord was immediately coming. At that time, the few who had begun to observe the seventh-day Sabbath had just discovered, from the seventh chapter of the book of Revelation, a sealing message which must go forth to prepare a people to stand in the great day of the Lord. These few said, "The last great battle cannot come yet, for here is a sealing work to prepare a people to stand in that great day." Mr. and Mrs. White and Mr. Bates were the three public laborers who were then teaching the Sabbath truth and the sealing message. They, with the few who had already accepted the message, were among the very poor of the world. On the evening already mentioned, these laborers and other brethren met at Otis Nichols' home to pray the Lord to guide them in publishing the sealing message to the world. As they prayed, Mrs. White was taken off in vision. While in vision, she said of the Sabbath truth, "It is the seal. That truth arises and is on the increase, stronger and stronger. It is coming up. It arises, commencing from the rising of the sun. Like the sun, at first cold, it grows warmer and sends its rays. the angels are holding the four winds. It is God that restrains the powers. The angels have not let go, for the saints are not all sealed. When Michael stands up, this trouble will be all over the earth. They, the winds of war, etc., are just ready to blow. There is a check put on because the saints are not sealed. Yea, publish the things thou hast seen and heard, and the blessing of God will attend. At the time that vision was given, it did really look as if the nations of the world would soon be in a whirlwind of war. Of the situation, United States Senator Choate said, "It has seemed to me as if the prerogatives of crowns and the rights of men and the hoarded-up resentments of 1,000 years were about to unsheath the sword for a conflict in which blood shall flow, as in apocalyptic vision, to the bridles of the horses." In a few months, the nations were all quiet again, but this change came on so unexpectedly that Horace Greeley, in speaking of it in the New York Tribune, said, "It was a great wonder to the politicians what started all that turmoil of the nations, but a greater wonder still what stopped it all so suddenly." After coming out of the vision already spoken of, Mrs. White said to her husband, "I saw that you must begin to print a paper, small at first, but as you send it out to the people, they will read it and will send you money with which to print it. It will be a success from the first." From that small beginning, it, the publishing work, was shown to me as streams of light that went around the entire world. The few believers had faith in that prediction, but were without money to begin the work. Many prayers were offered to God to open the way. In June 1849, the way opened, Mr. White having opportunity to mow 40 acres of grass with a hand scythe. With the money thus obtained, in July 1849, he printed the first number of a small paper entitled Present Truth. During 1849-50, 11 numbers of this paper were printed. In number 5, we read this statement, which was written by Mr. White. "The money our readers have sent in has been more than enough to print the paper. With the remainder, we have met the expenses of Mrs. White and myself as we went from place to place to hold meetings." So it was a success from the first. How from that small beginning has the published truth gone around the world? At the present time, Seventh-day Adventists have 27 publishing houses in different parts of the world. In these houses, over 70 steam power presses are used. This truth is issued from these offices in 67 languages of the world. The literature of the denomination in these languages consists of over 2,700 different books, pamphlets, and tracts, and 126 periodicals, either weekly, monthly, or quarterly. Each one of the smallest papers is about the size of the first paper, Present Truth. Up to January 1911, over $11 million worth of the books had been sold. Publishing houses, sanitariums, schools, and missions are established twice around the world, both north and south of the equator. That prediction, which looked preposterous to our opponents in 1848, is surely in a well-advanced state of fulfillment in 1911. True prophecies. We will now notice predictions made by Mrs. White concerning modern spiritualism in the years 1849-50. That of the former date reads, "I saw that the mysterious knocking in New York and other places was the power of Satan, and that such things would be more and more common, clothed in a religious garb so as to lull the deceived to greater security, and to draw the minds of God's people, if possible, to those things, and caused them to doubt the teachings and power of the Holy Ghost. Early Writings, page 43. At the time of this vision, there was only the rapping manifestation. Questions were asked, and the answer of yes or no was given by either two or three raps. The greater part of the people regarded the rappings, as they were then called, as trickery or sleight-of-hand performance. At that time, the idea was not even suggested that spirit rappings would assume to be a religious organization, as it has since done, with its titles of Reverend Blank, Pastor of the First Spiritualist Church of Blank, etc. In the vision of August 24, 1850, we read, "I was shown that by the rapping and mesmerism, these modern magicians would yet account for all the miracles wrought by our Lord Jesus Christ, and that many would believe that all the mighty works of the Son of God when on the earth were accomplished by this same power." It is since that vision was given in 1850 that spiritualists have taught, both in their oral instructions and in their printed books and papers, what they did not teach previously to that date, that all the miracles of Christ were wrought by the power of mesmerism and that he was only a well-developed medium. Another statement is given, taken from Early Writings, page 87, first printed in 1853. "I saw the rapping delusion, what progress it was making, and that if it were possible, it would deceive the very elect. Satan will have power to bring before us the appearance of forms purporting to be our relatives or friends now sleeping in Jesus. It will be made to appear as if these friends were present, the words that they uttered while here, with which we were familiar, will be spoken, and the same tone of voice that they had while living will fall upon the ear. All this is to deceive the saints and to ensnare them into the belief of this delusion." At the time this vision was given, the mode of communicating with the spirits was by calling over the letters of the alphabet and spelling out the communication, and by a rap, the spirits designated the letter wanted. No one had, at that date, heard of a case of what has been so much talked of during the last 30 years, the materializing of spirits, that is, the spirit assuming a bodily form, shaking hands with people, and talking with them in tones that they claim to recognize as the exact tone of voice of a dead relative or friend. It was about the years 1857-58, 4 years after Mrs. White had put in print that the spirits would assume the forms of dead friends, that mediums claimed to see their friends and to hear them speak. In the light of this rule for testing prophets, what can we say of the predictions made through Mrs. White concerning spiritualism? She stated, when it was not here, what would be done. The thing predicted came. That is, according to the Bible, proof of divine inspiration in the vision. Vision of the Civil War. In the further study of this question, we refer to a prediction made in a vision by Mrs. White at Parkville, Michigan, January 12, 1861, concerning the Civil War that was to come in the United States. At that time, only one state, South Carolina, had passed a secession ordinance. The people in the North little thought of a war growing out of that. In the New York Tribune of that week, Horace Greeley, the editor, said, "A few old women with broomsticks could go down there and beat out all the rebellion there is in South Carolina." In speaking of it the week before, he said, "If someone with the firmness of Andrew Jackson should go down there and say, 'South Carolina, where are you going?' they would reply, 'Back into the Union again, sir.'" After Mrs. White came out of the vision already referred to, she arose before the congregation and said, "There is not a person in this house that has ever dreamed of the trouble that is coming upon this land. People are making light of the secession ordinance of South Carolina. Some of the leading men of Parkville, while she thus spoke, sneered at the ideas she was advancing. But I have just been shown that a large number of states will join that state, and there will be a most terrible war. In this vision, I have seen large armies of both sides gathered on the field of battle. I heard the booming of the cannon and saw the dead and dying on every hand. I saw the field after the battle, all covered with the dead and dying. Then I was carried to prisons and saw the sufferings of those in want who were wasting away, etc." She further stated, "There are men in this house who will lose sons in that war." This vision, when given, was directly contrary to all Northern sentiment, but was nevertheless accurately fulfilled. Before the month of May 1861, 11 states had seceded and elected their Confederate president. On the 12th of April, the first gun of the war was fired on Fort Sumter, which surrendered on the 13th. The Northern idea of the war was then so meager that even President Lincoln called for only 75,000 men for 3 months to put down the rebellion. Little did the people in responsible places think they were entering upon a war to continue to the spring of 1865, a war in which the North would have in the field 2,859,132 men, and the South probably half that number. Not only was this vision accurately fulfilled concerning the secession of the states and the war itself, but as the war continued, other things were predicted. At first, the war was conducted with the thought of preserving the Union, allowing slavery to remain. But while that was the case, the North met many sad reverses. As I heard expressed by Governor St. John of Kansas, "Had we whipped the rebels, the politicians would have patched up a peace, and the Union would have then continued with slavery, and we would have it today." As the Northern Army met these reverses, national fast days were appointed, and all Christians were to plead with the Lord to manifest His power in bringing the war to a close. In a vision given to Mrs. White, January 4, 1862, speaking of these fasts, she said, "And yet a national fast is proclaimed. Saith the Lord, is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? When our nation observes the fast which God hath chosen, then will He accept their prayers as far as the war is concerned, but now they enter not into His ear." 5 months after this vision, the politicians of the North began to call for desperate measures. In June 1862, the Republican Standard of New Bedford, Massachusetts, said, "It is time to put into vigorous exercise that severity which is the truest mercy. It is time to proclaim freedom to the slave and thus strike treason to the heart." On January 1, 1863, President Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation. Of it, Governor St. John, in the speech previously mentioned, said, "But after Lincoln issued his famous Emancipation Proclamation, we had swung round on God's side and could not lose. From that time, it was a course of almost continuous success that attended the Northern Army." Of the predictions through Mrs. White concerning the war, we can truly say, all this came. And can we not, with firmer faith than exhibited by the Queen of Babylon, truly say that it was the Spirit of God that taught these things? Daniel 5, verses 10 to 12. The Lord's revelation of what he would do was through his servants, the prophets. Surely the Lord God will do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, the prophets. Amos 3, verse 7. And when the thing predicted came to pass, he expected all who professed to be his people to acknowledge it as a proof that he spoke the word, and that the instrument through whom he spoke was one of his true prophets. This principle is just as true in these modern days as in ancient times, and should be kept in mind when studying the instruction given by Paul in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, to prove all things that come in the form of prophesyings. Messenger Party. As a further application of the above rule, we call attention to a prediction made by Mrs. White in a vision given in Oswego, New York, June 20, 1855. It related to what was then called the Messenger Party, which consisted of disaffected ones who, having left the ranks, began a united opposition to the visions, claiming that, when rid of them, the third angel's message would at once go with a loud cry. This party printed a paper called the Messenger of Truth. From this, the party was named. They claimed to have more preachers than were left with us, and tauntingly said to Seventh-day Adventist ministers, "We will follow up and get all your converts." One by the name of Drew put it in these words, "You go ahead and shake the bush, and we will follow up and catch all the birds." The conflict was fierce and the opposition bitter. As expressed of them by another, "There is nothing to which they will not stoop, and they are never likely to be out of scandal with which to assail those who have incurred their displeasure." Until the Lord spoke directly concerning this party, our leading ministers considered it their duty to answer the scandalous falsehoods that were published in the Messenger of Truth. Elders White, Wagner, Cornell, and Frisbee, and the writer, counseled together and had arranged to write a reply to the malicious fabrications, each taking a separate line of attack. Just at this time, the vision, the writer being present, was given in Oswego. After coming out of the vision, Mrs. White, speaking to Elder White and the writer, said, "Brethren, you are mistaken as to your duty to answer the slanderous writings of the messenger. It is only a trick of the enemy to divert you from using your time in spreading the truth. When you answer one of their lies, they will manufacture two more. The Lord says to let them alone and go on with your work as if there was no such people on the earth, and in less than 6 weeks they will be at war among themselves. The candid ones will see their error and come back. The messenger company will go to pieces and their paper go down, while the third angel's message will advance more rapidly than ever. When their paper goes down, you will find that our ranks have doubled." And so it was. We let them alone and made no reference to them or their work in the review. First they complained, then they growled, and dared us for battle. In less than 4 weeks, some of their financial supporters left them, and the dissension and fight were on among themselves. The cause of present truth advanced in every phase of its work. A statement made in the review, January 14, 1858, just after the messenger paper breathed its last, having had a sickly existence of about 3 years, shows how accurately the prediction made in the Oswego vision was fulfilled. Speaking of the result of the messenger work, the editor said, "At the time of the disaffection, when the effort was made to break down the review, the church property at the office was worth only $700. Since, it has increased to $5,000. Then there were about 1,000 paying subscribers. Now there are 2,000, besides quite a free list. As the number of paying subscribers to the review had exactly doubled, so the number of believers had increased more than twofold. Be in health. John, the beloved apostle, wrote to Gaius these words, "I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth." 3 John 1, verse 2. This thought is also expressed in Paul's prayer for the people of God, even down to this time. "And the very God of peace sanctify you wholly, and I pray God, your whole spirit and soul and body, life, mind, and body, be preserved blameless unto the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Faithful is he that calleth you, who also will do it." 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 23 and 24. Instead of a spurious sanctification, the Lord delights in a truly sanctified people. But to perfect them and to accomplish his work in them, he hews them by the prophets. Hosea 6, verse 5. This fact, understood, leads to inquiry concerning what the Lord is now doing through the gift of prophecy in teaching a sanctification that corrects those wrong habits of eating and drinking which tend to build up the carnal nature instead of mortifying our members. Colossians 3, verse 5. Otsego Vision. June 6, 1863, at Otsego, Michigan, Mrs. White had the great and wonderful vision on healthful living, disease and its causes, drugs and their evil effects, etc. Regarding the nature of the principles there taught and the proofs in the vision itself of its divine inspiration, I will quote from the words of Dr. J. H. Kellogg in the preface to the book called Christian Temperance and Bible Hygiene, published in 1890. Number 1. At the time the writings referred to first appeared, the subject of health was almost wholly ignored, not only by the people to whom they were addressed, but by the world at large. Number 2. The few advocating the necessity of a reform in physical habits propagated in connection with the advocacy of genuine reformatory principles the most patent and, in some instances, disgusting errors. Number 3. Nowhere, and by no one, was there presented a systematic and harmonious body of hygienic truths free from patent errors and consistent with the Bible and the principles of the Christian religion. Under these circumstances, the writings referred to made their appearance. The principles taught were not enforced by scientific authority, but were presented in a simple, straightforward manner by one who makes no pretense to scientific knowledge, but claims to write by the aid and authority of divine enlightenment. How have these principles presented under such peculiar circumstances, and with such remarkable claims, stood the test of time and experience, is a question which may very properly be asked. Its answer is to be found in facts which are capable of the amplest verification. The principles which a quarter of a century ago, now more than 47 years ago, were either entirely ignored or made the butt of ridicule, have quietly won their way into public confidence and esteem, until the world has quite forgotten that they have not always been thus accepted. Every one of the principles advanced more than a quarter of a century ago is fortified in the strongest possible manner by scientific evidence. It certainly must be regarded as a thing remarkable and evincing unmistakable evidence of divine insight and direction that in the midst of confused and conflicting teachings, claiming the authority of science, a person making no claims to scientific knowledge or erudition should have been able to organize a body of hygienic principles so harmonious, so consistent, and so genuine that the discussions and researches and discoveries and the experience of a quarter of a century have not resulted in the overthrow of a single principle, but have only served to establish the doctrines taught. Since 1863, the time when the diet question and healthful living were unfolded to Mrs. White, the subject of health reform has been classed with the preparatory work for fitting up a people to meet the events before us. The Lord is leading His people back step by step to His original design that man should subsist upon the natural products of the earth. Mrs. White in 1863 further stated that from what had been revealed to her, the animals whose flesh was used for food would become more and more diseased until finally it would be unsafe to eat their flesh. The Lord was in mercy introducing these principles to His people, that by practicing them they might be better fitted to meet and resist the increase of disease upon the human family and stand unharmed amid the seven last plagues. The present increase of disease in the domestic animals is startling the nations of the earth. The Lord's people see in this fact the fulfilling of the predictions made 47 years ago concerning this very thing. Predictions Concerning Sunday Laws. In Testimonies, Volume 5, page 451, printed in 1885, is a statement as to how Sunday laws would be passed in the United States. It reads, "To secure popularity and patronage, legislators will yield to the demand for a Sunday law." Now, let us see how this has already been done. In 1892, a demand was made of Congress to prohibit the opening on Sunday of the World's Fair, which was to be in Chicago, Illinois, from May to October of that year. Such a law was passed July 19, 1892, under just such a pressure as above predicted. And be it remembered that this is the first time that the United States Congress ever legislated on the Sabbath question. The churches sent in immense lists of names and petitions and telegrams, not only petitioning Congress, but kindly informing the congressmen that we do hereby pledge ourselves and each other that we will, from this time henceforth, refuse to vote for or support for any office or position of trust, any member of Congress, either senator or representative, who shall vote for any further aid of any kind for the World's Fair except on conditions named in these resolutions. The conditions were that the fair should be closed on Sunday. As a sample of the talk on the floors of Congress, when the bill was passed, read the following, quote, "I should like to see the disclaimer put in white and black and proposed by the Congress of the United States. Write it. How would you write it? Word it if you dare. Advocate it if you dare. How many who voted for it would ever come back here again? None, I hope. You endanger yourselves by opposing it." Close quote. Thus we see how that testimony given in 1885 has been and is being fulfilled. Catholic and Protestant Unity. Here is another prediction found also in Testimonies for the Church, Volume 5, page 207. Published in 1885. "When Protestantism shall stretch her hand across the gulf to grasp the hand of the Roman power, when she shall reach over the abyss to clasp hands with spiritualism, when under the influence of this threefold union, our country shall repudiate every principle of its constitution as a Protestant and Republican government, and shall make provision for the propagation of papal falsehoods and delusions, then we may know that the time is come for the marvelous working of Satan, and that the end is near." To show how the first part of this prediction is already fulfilling, we need only to call attention to what is transpiring around us. See Protestants, both ministers and people, courting the favor of Catholics, inviting them to attend their associations and join with them in their religious and political federations. Be it remembered that hardly a vestige of what is now seen in this line was apparent in 1885, when the above testimony was given. As a sample of how the Protestants are reaching for the hand and help of Papists, I will quote from the Kansas City, Missouri Star of March 18, 1896. Catholic and Methodist St. Patrick's Day. A speech was delivered in Coates Opera House, Kansas City, Missouri, on St. Patrick's Day, March 17, 1896, by Dr. Mitchell, pastor of the leading Methodist Church of Kansas City. The Star speaks of a portion of the speech as a dramatic little scene. Dr. Mitchell was loudly applauded when he said this, quote, "Bigotry is the child of ignorance. We are bigoted because we do not know our neighbors well enough. We Protestants have been taught to believe unutterable things of Catholics. Catholics have been taught to believe unutterable things of Protestants. Now we discover our mistaken notions of each other when we get close enough to look into each other's eyes and clasp each other's hands. If we only knew each other more, we would love each other better. We have stood apart and criticized. Shame upon the followers of the blessed Christ. All Christians have been redeemed by the same precious blood. We are sustained by the same divine grace and expect to reach the same heaven. Say, brothers, we had better be getting acquainted with each other down here." Close quote. Dr. Mitchell then turned to Father Dalton, Catholic priest, who sat just behind him, and, reaching out his hand, said, "Here, Brother Dalton, is my hand." Father Dalton arose and clasped the extended hand, and as Dr. Mitchell shook it, he said, "It would be an awful shame if, after living so long in the same city on earth, we would have to get an angel to introduce us to each other in heaven. Let us get acquainted here on earth." The audience applauded, and after Father Dalton sat down, Dr. Mitchell continued his speech. Let it be remembered that that audience was largely Protestant, which joined in that vociferous cheering that followed this speech. The Church Federation of Protestant Churches, in 1905, sent to Cardinal Gibbons, Catholic, the 10 points of their plan of operations. He replied that he fully approved of their plans. Prediction of sanitarium sites. On March 18, 1902, a number of us were called together at the Los Angeles Treatment Rooms on 3rd Street to consider a proposition to buy a site on the corner of South Hill and 4th Streets for a sanitarium. The price was $100,000 for the bare lot, and this money would have to be hired, as also the money to erect a sanitarium if one was built. As there was much hesitancy with us on the propriety of making such a venture, a testimony from Sister White was received through the mail. She was 500 miles off and knew not of our counsel on any such proposition. The testimony said, "Do not build a sanitarium in Los Angeles. Our sanitariums should be out in the country. While it may be right to hire treatment rooms in the city, do not build in the city. The Lord has shown me that there are properties that have been erected that are just fitted to our work, which for some cause have not been occupied, that will be offered to us at very low figures." That settled the question with us. No one of our people knew of any such properties. Search has resulted in what? Glendale, Paradise Valley, and Loma Linda, which were all fitted ready for our work, and each obtained at about 1/3 of what had been invested in them. These predictions, made through Mrs. White, so accurately fulfilled and fulfilling in accordance with Rule 5, show her to be a true prophet of the Lord.